In recent decades, we've read so often of difficulties existing between President and Congress, of deadlock, really, between these two branches of government.
I think that when you talk about deadlock in the American system, you should talk about its potential for deadlock. It's not inevitable. It never has been. The potential is there, and it's sometimes it's very much higher than it is at others. From, say, 37, 38 on through until we got into World War II, it was there, and nothing that Franklin Roosevelt could do could prevent it. It was there, and most of the time that Truman was president. And there wasn't very much that any man could have done in those circumstances. But that didn't mean that it was root and branch inevitable in the institutional structure itself. The potential was there, but it didn't have to be there. Unless there is at least some potential or some minor degree of deadlock possible in the system, then you don't get the independence or the degree of independence that you desire on the part of the legislative body. Then you get something like the House of Commons, where the legislature almost is obliged to do the government's bidding. A suggestion has been made by various people, including Walter Lippmann, that at the beginning of each congressional session, the president would indicate much more explicitly than he currently does those items of legislation on which he feels it is absolutely imperative to get a congressional decision. And the Congress, both houses of Congress, would commit themselves to reach some kind of a decision on any one of those that he listed, not necessarily to back the president, but to act on them, not forever to postpone. And this, I think, would be a very healthy thing. It would do two things that would be important. The obvious one is that then the tendency just to bottle things up and not permit them to get a vote, and thus stymie and frustrate the president, would be reduced. Second place, it probably would induce the president and his immediate associates to be awfully careful about what things they actually put on this list. Because there are things on which a president makes a public display of intention for the Congress to act, and he hopes to heaven that they won't act. And they know it, and he knows it. And there's certain resentment can grow up there, because then he can sometimes politically whip them for not having acted when in his heart of hearts he really wishes they wouldn't. So that there would be, I think, gains on both sides if this sort of special legislative program of the president were something that the Congress committed itself to act upon one way or another in a given session. You'd have a kind of a clear yes or no, although there would obviously be amendments possible and all that sort of thing. But this might go a long way toward pulling things toward the center, strengthening the center of the system without necessarily great risk. Your critical powers wouldn't be lost by this. Dispersal of power between the executive and the legislative branch is in some respects sound. I've indicated I wanted to have some independence. What I would like to do is to have them tested on essentially the same kinds of grounds, which would tend to probably to reduce this tendency toward deadlock somewhat. A source of this deadlock is the degree to which the members of the Senate and the House, in fact, have political stakes that are not the same as the president's. This is facilitated by the off-year elections. It's facilitated by the degree to which the nominating and financing of candidates is a local matter rather than a national matter. The first of these results in the possibility that, particularly in an off-year election, the members of the House and the Senate who are up for re-election may be running basically on considerations that have nothing to do with what the president's up to. And the latter, the matter of the nominating and financing, tends to a degree to accentuate that. So that if a man is able to get himself financed and to keep himself reasonably in good with those who are important in his constituency, he can thumb his nose at the president. Now, you don't want to do away with that entirely. Because, again, if you do, the possibility of a degree of independence is going to be lost. But I think it would be possible in various ways to begin to encourage some shift in this direction of more nearly nationalizing the stakes and making them more like the president's stakes without its becoming too risky. Now, we've had some tendencies in this direction anyhow, because if we look back over this century, the degree to which a president now is permitted politically to intervene in elections, and even to some degree openly in nominations for Congress and for Senate, is very much greater than it was 60 years ago. This seems to me to be a good thing. What it means is that the president, in effect, can get by, as even Franklin Roosevelt really couldn't in 1938. He tried to purge certain members of Congress, and it was a badly planned operation, and most people have concluded from that that it can't be done. I would conclude that it can't be done unless it's done well, and there is a difference. But even since 38, the degree to which a president can move in on this situation, in effect, say, this is a referendum on me as well as on your nominee or your possible nominee here, and think of both of these things before you cast your vote. This, I think, is an important thing and a good thing. And, of course, a greater degree of centralization in financing of campaigns would tend to increase the dependence on a national operation to some degree. If, for example, instead of every member of Congress and every member of the Senate or aspirant thereto going out raising his own funds, you had all the funds contributed to the National Committee and then doled out from the center, there would be a very significant shift in who listened to whom. You perhaps wouldn't want completely to nationalize the financing, but if it were a heavier thing than it is now, you would tend to accentuate the national stakes that are involved in this. Now, this is a very controversial point on which a lot of people would disagree, and there's risk involved in it. I would concede that.
What kind of risk?
Well, the risk that you destroy the independence that you want to protect in an appropriate degree. It's another one of these balancing things, you know. When these things tend to get debated in the newspapers and so on, they tend to get put in these sort of either-or terms. You don't, it seems to me, sensibly say localization versus nationalization. You say what degree of localization versus what degree of nationalization. Yes, a legislature that is a legislature in any sense of the term, and appropriately, is one that needs to reflect local variations and local demands in the national arena. If you eliminated that, it would be a weaker body. The local issue that is a genuine local issue is not likely to be eliminated in that fashion, so long as other elements of our freedom are not also liquidated. And if that happens, no matter what system we have, we're in trouble. A local issue that is genuine and real and has its roots in a constituency where it means something is going to make itself felt, because the essential nature of such a local issue is something that is in the direct experience of the people who are going to the polls. It's something that hits their pocketbooks. It hits their everyday life. They don't have to be told about it on television or through the newspapers or anything. They know it from their direct experience. This is the kind of local issue that must be in the stream of things and which cannot be eliminated by this process, because the alternative would be simply the defeat of those who ignored the issue. So no amount of centralization in your political apparatus is going to eliminate that possibility. I think the genuine localism will always make itself felt and should. Can't have a big, diverse country without doing it. But it will call attention to the relation of these local things to the national things, and that's the key of the thing.
Isn't it true that traditionally most Americans are wary of giving too much power to the central government?
We tend to disperse power throughout the whole political scheme with somehow the idea that that's protective. Well, actually, dispersed power is often more dangerous than focused and centralized power. If the centralized power has attention focused on it, if there's publicity connected with it, if people can see more or less what is going on, then it's easier in a way to control a centralized power situation than one's highly dispersed, which can get kind of like a shell game. You never know who's doing what. And this is often true of our governmental system.
How does this relate to the way Congress works?
The problem of the dispersion of power inside the Congress involves the division of labor which is necessary when a body is dealing with a complex process, as one even would in a corporation, but where the guiding, coordinating leadership of the organization is not sufficient to be able to keep those pieces from going off on their own. And it specifically refers to the ability of committees, subcommittees, and their chairmen to act as if they were almost little governments by themselves, and the relative weakness of the common leadership of the two chambers, particularly, say, on the majority side in the House, the Speaker and the Majority Leader, and on the Senate, the Majority Leader and his immediate associates. These are men elected by their own fellow partisans to guide, to some degree, the business of the two chambers. And The problem of dispersion is the relative inequality of influence and leverage in their hands as compared with individual key senators and congressmen, characteristically chairman or subcommittee chairman, to act as they will counter to the leadership. There is, in effect, a kind of veto possibility involved. Now, what you have in the character of the committee system, in the power of committee chairman, in the power even of subcommittee chairman, in the relative informality and weakness of the power of the leadership of the parties in the House and the Senate, here you have all manner of points at which it is possible to prevent things from happening. You can delay getting bills out of committee. You can prolong them with very long hearings. You can bring in reports. Even if you report a bill, you can bring it in with a negative recommendation. You can, in effect, suggest to people who are on the fence that if they go along with the committee on this bill, then there's another bill that will also get the nod, and the reverse. You get the possibility, as you've had over the years, of the Rules Committee in the House being able to thwart the power of the leadership in the House to get things done. In other words, there's dispersal of power throughout the Congress itself, which makes it possible for men at various points along the line to stop things from happening, or to water them down, or to weaken them. I think it is unquestionably true that though the chairman of the standing committees haven't the power today, maybe in most instances that they once had, that they still have rather more power than they ought to have. That is, the power of a minority to say no when a majority might want to say yes, if the majority could get an opportunity, in fact, to express its will. This, I think, is something on which the balance is structurally somewhat the wrong way.
What would you like to see done about this situation?
The means of correction would be means of making those who were in these positions more responsive to the central leadership. I don't want to make the Speaker of the House a czar again. I don't want to make the majority leader of the Senate the equivalent of what the Speaker of the House once was. A dictator is not what you want. I think the danger wouldn't be terribly great if only because the leadership would likely be pretty careful to be certain that whatever actions they took in fact reflected at least majority support, or else they themselves would be in difficulty. What I want to do is to strengthen their hands somewhat more than they are at the present time. We're talking now about such things as the seniority rule for the selection of committee chairman, which has some advantages to it. But it might be, for example, a useful thing if the party caucuses in the Senate and the House, the majority ones, were able to choose the chairman of committees, say, from among the three top senior people on that committee, which would mean that the Speaker in the House and his immediate associates and the majority leader in the Senate and his immediate associates would probably have some influence as to which one of these three would get the nod. And the likelihood then of their having to live for a long period of time with someone as the chairman of a committee who in fact was opposed to everything that they, as representatives of a majority, wanted to do would be to that degree reduced. And we have a curious kind of thing in the Congress, you know, in the last 20 years. We had a so-called reform of Congress in 1946, whose chief accomplishment was heralded as being the reduction in the number of committees. Well, what it did was reduce the number of formal committees, but the equivalent of those is actually larger today than it was in 1946 because it increased the number of subcommittees. And frequently, not invariably, but frequently, the powers of a subcommittee chairman are as great as a committee chairman, both with respect to the leadership and with respect to the chairmanship of the parent committee. So that there's been this kind of dispersal that has occurred, and it also had the effect, to some degree, of weakening, especially in the House, the powers of the Speaker in the name of one of our great values in the society, namely efficiency. As we streamlined the committees and very much more sharply defined exactly what their jurisdictions should be. And by so doing, we reduced the discretion available to the Speaker in whether he would refer a bill to one committee rather than to another. It's much more difficult now for a speaker to use his discretion and suggest that a bill that he's really interested in should go to this committee rather than that one, because the jurisdictional boundaries are sufficiently sharply defined so that there's going to be a protest from the floor which is likely to be supported. Ambiguity of this sort is very important for leadership, and it's been reduced by this, so that in a way you can say that, curiously, the reform of Congress, whose major objectives were never very clear except in such things as efficiency and so on, was in a sense a step backward.
The reform of 1946, again in the name of efficiency, brought about a sizable increase in the staffs of members of Congress and of congressional committees. We asked Professor Truman how important these staff people are to a senator or to a member of the House of Representatives.
They're very important. They're increasingly important for the reasons that we were talking about from the outset, about the complexity of the things he faces, politically and substantively as a policymaker in government. And he has to worry about both these things. A good staff man who can keep him informed, who can study bills, who can listen downtown in the executive, who can help him looking after his constituents' demands and interests in particular detail as well as in general, is a very important asset to any representative or senator. Perhaps more important to a senator than to a congressman, because of the size of the constituency that the senator has to deal with. There is a core, the staff of the Senate particularly, but also to some degree true in the House, constitutes a kind of bureaucracy in itself. They all know each other. There are many men who have developed a career as staff men on the Hill, either committee staff men or attached to particular senators or congressmen. These can be men who develop the line of questioning that the senator is going to follow. They may not only help, but they may write his speeches on the floor. They're a very key element in the whole operation. There is danger there, as there is in any bureaucracy, that it gets on top rather than being below. And this is one of the reasons why some people are not too enthusiastic about seeing much more expansion in the staff, because then the question is, who's going to control it? That begins to get important. A good senator, a skillful one, or representative, uses his staff, and it's very clear who's the boss. But it can go the other way. But whether it's good, it works well, or badly in this sense, the staff still constitutes a kind of corporate body which is very important. There are careers that have been, very important careers that have been built as staff members of particular committees, men who have spent 30, 40 years of their whole active life as a staff man on a particular committee of the House or of the Senate. Not a great many of these, but there are some. They can be exceedingly important in handling the whole business of the committee, and they can be very highly skilled. They're kind of career bureaucrats. This is a career civil service in a way, although it's neither civil service nor formally career.
There is another important group of people with whom the member of Congress deals, the lobbyists. We asked Professor Truman about lobbying activity generally, and in particular, whether a lobbyist can be of real service to a senator or representative.
In many respects, he may be very well served, because a good lobbyist can also almost be an additional staff man for him. The lobbyist may be very well informed, and a skillful congressman will very quickly find out which is the lobbyist who knows what he's doing and talking about and the one that's just fanning the breeze. He may come to rely on the lobbyist to inform him about the things he should raise with the bureaucrat. This can be a very useful function. Lobbyists are not necessarily bad. I would say they are very important, because this is one set of channels through which people can express their preferences, and it is one source from which congressmen learn the things that they ought to be listening to. So I think it is clearly very important. I don't think one should worry about it as a great threat to the system, a great conspiracy against democracy or anything like that. I don't think it necessarily requires elaborate regulatory activity to control it. Where there is an intimate relation between the lobbyist and the member of the Senate or the House, it's often a mutuality of interest, not a pressure sort of thing. It's a shared concern. They may help each other, in effect. And I mean by this nothing improper or dishonest about it. Frequently we get our explosions about the activities of lobbies because there will be minor excesses that have accumulated around a particular piece of legislation, and the members of the House or the Senate will kind of collectively defend themselves against these excesses by beginning to denounce the activities of lobbyists. These kinds of excesses, which in a sense threaten or are seen by the senators and representatives as threats to the institution themselves, will be resisted, and one of the ways to resist them is to have an investigation and parade them. Occasionally, of course, it comes out of an alleged scandal, as in the case of some of the charges that were made a few years ago during the Eisenhower administration on the natural gas business, you remember. That never got completely explored, I would say, although there was a lot of print on it. But it certainly had the effect of sort of saying to the whole crowd of those around, don't get too insistent, boys. This is our bailiwick. We're glad to see you. We're glad to talk to you. But we're the congressman. You're not. The institution responds this way quite regularly.
We have been discussing the Congress of the United States with David B. Truman, professor of government and dean of Columbia College. Professor Truman has given us a provocative personal look into the nature of Congress, and in so doing, he has commented upon a wide range of issues which are important to our understanding of the Congress. The Congress of the United States today is clearly not precisely the institution that it was 150 years ago, or even 50 years ago. But as Professor Truman has suggested, its strengths, its accomplishments, its essential value as an integral part of our government and of our society remain close to the center of American democracy.